This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As you do your shopping this year between the sales, the crowds, the recession, I bet you're thinking pretty hard as you navigate the shopping mall and the supermarket. These days especially, you make careful decisions every time you fork over your credit card, weighing your options, the quality of the item, how much you really want it. Well, guess what? You may think you're making rational choices. You may believe you are, but a lot of the time, you're not. The emotional parts of your brain intervene before your intellect even knows what's going on. And it turns out that the same mechanisms apply whether you're choosing a power drill for Uncle Ed, a baseball team, a movie star, or a politician. We're talking about the cutting edge of marketing and technology, neuromarketing, it's called, and it beats the pants off standard market research because it doesn't rely on what we tell pollsters or how a few of us react in a focus group. It looks directly into our brains. Martin Lindstrom spent 4 years and $7 million on a project to combine market research and advanced scanning devices. He joins us in just a moment. Later in the hour, a triplet of stories coming out of Chicago, all the buzz from the Tribune's bankruptcy, laid off workers holding a sit-in to astonishing corruption charges against Governor Rod Blagojevich. We'll check in on the Windy City. But first, why do you buy what you buy? What's the brand loyalty you've never been able to shake and you still can't explain it? Tell us your story. Our phone number, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Martin Lindstrom is a marketing expert and the author of Biology, Truth and Lies About What We Buy, and he joins us from the studios of Schweizer Radio in Bern, Switzerland, and nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Well, thanks, Neil. Thanks for inviting me.
And let's begin with the Pepsi challenge. A test showed that about half of us prefer Pepsi in blind taste tests, nowhere close to their actual market share. But then it gets really interesting when people know in advance that this cup is Pepsi and that cup is Coke.
Well, exactly what happened was really surprising, because when people were not aware of what they were drinking, they loved Pepsi. But when they were told, while they had their brain scanned using fMRI, the total opposite happened. The preference for the taste changed its mind, literally, and said, hey, I don't like Pepsi anymore. I actually prefer Coke. So what we learned here is that emotions, time after time, actually overrides almost everything in our brains and make us change our mind, and we really believe what we're thinking.
And so, as you put it, the generations of advertisements, all the jingles suddenly go off in our heads. The very cokiness of Coke, as you put it, is what makes our emotional part of our brain think, I like Coke.
Well, that's true. You know, and what's fascinating about this, it happens every time. You have to remember when you and I walk down the supermarket aisle, about 60% of all the brands we buy, we made those decisions in only 4 seconds. So literally, there's no way we can go through a concrete, deep analysis of every brand we pick down. Typically, it is our subconscious part of the brain which are making the choices for us.
Our subconscious parts of the brain, and fMRI can tell us that how?
Well, the way it works is very simple. You know, when we ask people in focus groups or whatever techniques we have, we answer things which we think are real or what we think is the truth. But the case is we're so influenced by everything. We don't like the person interviewing us. It may be in a bad mood today. Or it really means that perhaps I actually am not saying the truth because I'm not aware of what the truth is. With fMRI and other similar neuroscience-based technologies, we look into the brain. And what we do with fMRI, and the F stands for functional, we basically are running a whole movie of the brain to see what regions in the brain are activated. So, for example, when we did an amazing smoking study to see why people are smoking, we looked into an area called the nucleus accumbens. And that's basically the craving spot in our brain. And when we could see that being activated, it fired or lit it up as a fireball. And then we knew there was activity going on. Then we had a team of professors and doctors out of Oxford in UK analyzing the data and then helping us to conclude what really goes on as people are exposed for ads or TV commercials or whatever it may be.
And the astonishing part of that smoking study was you were trying to figure out the effects of the warnings on cigarette boxes, and not just the namby-pamby warnings that we have in the United States, but the really horrifying things, pictures of black lungs and that sort of thing that they have on some of the European cigarette packages. And it showed that, in fact, even when you're seeing horrible images and the word smoking kills, it turns out smokers want to smoke more.
Yeah, Neil, you're exactly right about what you're saying. No, here's the scary part. We actually smoke much more than we did in the past. If you take the entire world's population over the last 3 years, we smoked 13% more. It's the same as 15 billion cigarettes which are puffed up every day across the world. So I wanted to find out why. And that's the reason why we decided to look into the health warnings. And those health warnings in North America is not very dramatic. In fact, even the European ones, which are saying smoking kill, and it actually takes the space of half a packet, is not as dramatic as the one from Canada and Brazil and Thailand and Australia, where you literally see lungs and arms and legs cut off as a reflection of smoking too much. Whenever we scanned consumers' brains, smokers and former smokers, what happened was that the nucleus accumbens, so the craving spot in their brains, again were lighting up as a fireball. We literally could see that one of the most powerful tools to make people smoke was the health warnings on cigarette packs.
We're talking with Martin Lindstrom about his book, Biology, Truth and Lies About Why We Buy. If you'd like to join the conversation, tell us about the brand loyalty you can't shake and can't quite explain. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Let's begin with Matt, and Matt's calling us from St. Augustine in Florida.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call. I grew up with my dad in love. I'm 48 years old, and my dad was in love with Chrysler all his life. And I grew up with that sort of brand loyalty passed on. And I remember having an old beater of the Dodge Dart, and it was bulletproof. But as we got into the 70s, we ended up with a few automobiles that were really pretty horrible. And it took us a long time to shake that brand loyalty. It just all seemed kind of relevant to this topic today, considering with the big three auto bailout. And I just thought I'd ask your comments on that. Are we a little irrational in some of the big three that we still seem to be tied to?
Martin Lindstrom, does the same mechanism apply if we're talking about a big ticket item like an automobile, or when we're talking about a Coke or Pepsi?
Absolutely. In fact, it counts even more, because a big ticket item is something we've been saving for a long time. Typically, we will use it over many years because it's so expensive. And typically, we buy that item because it also tells the surrounding world who we are. So when Matt is telling this story, it's not unusual. In fact, what we can see is that people typically, if they really are in love with a brand and it really sort of, you know, is letting them down, they typically are first changing the brand after the third attempt where they've been let down, because that is the brand loyalty. In the end of the day, Matt, by the way, your loyalty is almost like a human being, not the same, but almost. It's like if you have a good friend and he's letting you down once, you will not skip him. It has to take a couple of tries before he really manages to make sure he doesn't like you and you don't like him anymore. So really, it's the same here. It may be not as dramatic, but it's the same mechanism we're talking about. It's emotions in a systematic way.
That describes my experience to a T. It took a couple of Dodge Aspens and Plymouth Volaris to realize, hey, man, maybe we need to go Japanese, and that's what we went doing.
But,
well,
Matt, I had to ask you.
I'll take my call, and I'll listen on the air now. Thanks again.
Sounds good.
All right, Matt, thanks very much. Let's see if we can go quickly now to William. William with us from Nashville, Tennessee.
Well, I just caught the very end of that last call of the Chrysler guy and Dodge. It's kind of funny because I just looked up online Ford and J.D. Power, and I found out that last year Ford won more model awards than Toyota did. And I was just wondering how many people would actually, you know, say that or believe that.
Even if they see it on television advertising. And Martin Lindstrom, that's one of the things you were investigating. How come advertising is so ineffectual?
Well, the reason why is because you and I are exposed for 2 million television commercials throughout life. That's the same as watching 8 hours of TV commercials 7 days a week for 6 years. That's really depressing, isn't it? And what happens right now is that, you know, the advertising industry cannot reach you anymore because you have a filter which is incredibly thick. So what they're trying to do now is to capture your subconscious mind instead. And some brands are really good at that. For example, Apple. No, we love Apple, and we love Apple not necessarily because the MP3 player, which is inside this iPod device, is so great. We love it for other reasons. You know, what we actually saw from the biology study when we scanned people belonging to the faith of Christianity, and then we compared that with people which are strong fans of Apple, was exactly the same regions in the brains were activated. So hate me and love me, but the fact is that Apple is a mini religion. So what's happening here is it's not just me buying a brand, it's suddenly a love affair which is much more deep, so much so that I believe in a brand to an extreme degree. And that is something which really doesn't count if it's a lot of new models coming out. At the end of the day, it's something else which counts for me. That is, the brand listens to me, I admire the brand, and people admire me because I wear or buy that brand.
So, Matt, William, I guess the problem is we've all become devout Toyotaists, and it's going to take a while before we reinvestigate the Ford faith.
No, I'll do it. I'll do it, but I know most people won't.
All right, William, thanks very much.
Bye.
And happy driving. The fascinating thing about all of these studies seems to be that this applies not just, as we suggested earlier, not just to cars and toothpaste and soda pop, but to a lot of things, as you suggest, even asking people about their faith.
Yeah, that's right. You know, what we decided to do was to take a look at fans which are really hardcore fans of a brand. You know, I was in Sydney the other day as they opened the new Apple store. And guess what? I met up with a young guy, Matt, and he's been waiting in line for 48 hours. And I said to him, why are you here? He said, I flew in from California, USA. Now, that's only a 17-hour flight to Australia. And I said to him, why are you here? He said, I love the brand. I said, what do you get out of this? He said, well, I get a T-shirt. And that's very much, you know, a good reflection of when you really are a fan of a brand, something else is going on. What we learned now and what the advertising community is starting to learn now is that strong religions actually are incredibly powerful because they have some ingredients. Those are rituals and mystery and enemy pitches. And those ingredients are now being adapted into the world of brands.
And we'll talk more about that in just a moment. Martin Lindstrom is with us. Again, his book is called Biology, Truth and Lies, about why we buy. What's your brand loyalty? And how do you keep from shaking it? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation, NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Negative political ads work. We've heard that one before. Now, new research also tells us that product placement in movies is rarely effective, that many huge ad campaigns don't work at all, that what you smell can be as important as what you see in buying some products. We're talking with the author of the new book, Biology, Truth and Lies, About What We Buy, About Why We Buy. Martin Lindstrom is a marketing and branding expert who studied the brains of shoppers to get the answers to those questions. In one case, a woman in Middlesex thought the warnings on cigarette packs were working on her. Not exactly. Read about her turn in the fMRI machine on our website at npr.org/talk. So why do you buy what you buy? What's the brand loyalty you've never been able to shake? Can you explain it? 800-989-8255 is the phone number. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Let's continue with Walter. Walter is with us from Kansas City.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Hi there.
How are you? I am, first of all, overall largely offended by marketing in general. Marketing works, and I'm not sure if I like that fact. And this new twist on this new neuromarketing that you're describing is just, in my opinion, kind of another scary twist. My view on marketing in the past is that basically it's legal fibbing, lying. Free speech allows false claims to be made on, let's say, you know, a good example is nutritional supplements, you know, that can do everything from enhance your whatever to fix your memory to all sorts of stuff. And I think we need to recognize that marketing is manipulation, and I don't know if regulation is the answer or what. And marketing marketers would argue that people, you know, they're just responding with their free will to what we're saying. But I don't know. I wonder if your guest could comment on the free will being maybe subverted by, you know, old marketing methods, and then especially this this new method, this new
campaigns that employ these new techniques. Yes, go ahead, Martin Lindstrom.
Well, listen, Walter, I 100% agree with you. I think that advertising is going too far right now. And I think the main problem here is that there's not a lot of regulations in North America about what you can and what you can't say. And I'm not saying regulation is the answer to everything, but I certainly am saying that sometimes in order to you communicating to kids or saying certain statements in the air, which really are not truthful, no, should not be legal. And I think many countries are failing on that criteria. So first of all, let me say one thing, I 100% agree with you. The second thing I want to say, neuromarketing is a little bit like a hammer. You can either hang up a beautiful painting on the wall and it's pretty positive, or you can use it as a weapon. And that's exactly the case here as well. When I decided to write the book and conduct this study, I wanted to do this study because people are fearful of neuromarketing. Can we place a buy bot in consumers' brains? Is this the next generation of manipulation? Can we do bad stuff to consumers? And I wanted to find out, mainly because if we never find out, this monster may actually turn into become a monster and people actually will not be aware of it and can't stop it. Now, here's the good news, Walter. None of those things are possible. The good news is as well, we now actually can stop bad advertisers to do some bad stuff. And one of the industries I'm attacking big way is the tobacco industry, which in fact now, and we've proven that from the biology study, is running and using subliminal advertising, which were banned in 1957. That means that you are affected by subconscious signals around you every day. If you go into a London pubs, for example, they're actually placing small red tiles in the bathrooms, and they're doing that funded by the tobacco companies to make you want to smoke more at a subconscious level. That is what we're discovering right now. So I think it's not just for the worse, actually it's for the better in some cases too.
Here's something you wrote in your book. I wanted to read into this. I'm as susceptible to products and brands as anyone. I also want to sleep well at night knowing I've done the right thing. This is about, then you add in, over the years, I've turned down projects that, in my opinion, crossed that line. Like what? What projects have you turned down because they crossed the line?
Many projects, you know, the entire tobacco industry has actually attacked me over the last 2-3 years. They actually were the first in the world to hear about this project and try to stop it 3 times. Later on, 14 times we've been contacted by most of the larger tobacco companies around the world. It's also certain beverages, certain types of food categories, certain types of toys where I feel that the kids are being destroyed by using the toys, or where there's a war theme, which I really don't like. In general, I try to stay away from communicating to kids using neuromarketing, not using other techniques, as long as they're ethical correct. So I'm really trying to set my own standard. That said, Neil, the case here is that there is no regulation around when it comes to neuromarketing, and that's really one of the main reasons why I'm writing the book, because I want to start a debate exactly like with what Walter is saying, to make sure that we as consumers are aware of this is happening and can put a line in the sand and saying how far should this go, where should we stop, and what should be legal.
Walter, thanks very much for the call.
Neil?
Yeah.
Neither here nor there, but I don't know if either of you have been watching Mad Men the last 2 seasons, but I just picked it up recently and I've just really enjoyed it.
And it's instructive as well as entertaining.
Yes.
Thanks very much, Walter. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Now we have an email from Brian in Pilesville, Maryland, who's teaching a marketing class at a high school there. The class is listening live, and they have also watched some of your videos on your website, and he's encouraged some of his students to submit questions today. But he also submitted a question. Can you give us an example of a product that did everything correctly but still failed to connect with the consumer? How did it go wrong?
Absolutely. Now, I think the Segway is a very good example of that. You remember the Segway, where this is like a mini car into 2 wheels, which mm-hmm. you can stand on and it can run away. That one was predicted even by Steve Jobs to be the killer application of the world. They expected to sell almost millions of that Segway. And guess what? They only sold in the hundreds in the beginning of the release period. Everything was right. They even had promotions on Amazon.com. They had a lot of PR, so much PR that I don't think any other release of a car has managed to have that much attention. But in the end of the day, what really happened here was that the mystery was not there. They did everything right and everything went wrong. And what we see is, and I want to say that too to the class listening right now, 9 out of 10 of all new product releases around the world is failing. Guess what? In Japan, it's 9.7 out of 10 new product releases which are failing. The reason why? We're more skeptical. Point one is consumers, which is good. But the second reason why is because when we interview consumers and we ask them what they really want, what they're saying and what really is the truth, very rarely actually match together. Typically, we can't express what we want. And that's the reason why a lot of products are totally waste of money.
Here's one of the students writing a question, Lauren in Pilesville, Maryland. With all the logos and brand names that are shown in movies and TV shows today, will these soon be eliminated as a result of customer loyalty changing? Do people really pay attention to brands shown in the movies and TV enough to even continually include them?
Well, absolutely, Lauren. And I think, you know, I want to take you back into a fascinating story, which I love. The Coca-Cola bottle was developed in 1915. And the briefing originally was pretty intelligent. The briefing was to develop a bottle which is so systematically designed that if you break it down on the floor and it smashes into thousands of pieces of glass, you can still pick up one piece of glass and recognize the brand. And I call that theory for smash your brand. And what's so powerful about that is if you take an Apple iPod today and look at it in the front, there's no logo on it. You still recognize that this is Apple. If you look at United Colors or Benetton, their ads, or you look at a Tiffany box, you will see that Rubin color is enough to tell you who the brand is. That is going to be the next generation of how to build brands. You're no longer going to see the logo there. You're going to see what I define as smashable components, so a color, a shape. Just think about Wall-E, the Disney movie. There you have a very shiny robot walking around. Supposedly that's sponsored by Apple. It looks like an Apple, but you really can't see it because there's no logo on it. At least on a subconscious level, however, we're aware of that this is the Apple brand. And that's the way brands are going to appear as a product placement feature, that you're not going to see the logo. You're going to see signals indirectly telling the story about the brand.
So it will matter less that James Bond prefers a certain brand of vodka. It's really the more subtle signal that will work.
Well, that's right. You know, and I think, Neil, when it comes to James Bond, you know, he spent around $100 million product placement-wise in the latest movie, which was released a couple of weeks ago here in the United States. And what's interesting is we can see from the study is that mostly it's a total waste of money. If you take a look at American Idol, which we were testing, where we tested Coca-Cola, we tested Ford and Singular before they turned into be AT&T, we learned that Coca-Cola was doing a great job, and so was, by the way, Singular, now AT&T, but Ford was a total waste of money. And the reason why was because our brains want to make sure they can justify why a brand is appearing in a movie. If it supports the storyline, if it actually becomes a hero, our brain will say, hey, that makes sense, let me remember that. But if it's totally out of context, then suddenly the brain will actually delete the brand in the brain. And then I just have to say it to you, what the heck does a Ford car have to do with a singing contest? And that's the reason why Ford was spending supposedly $26 million sponsoring that show every year, literally is deleting the brand in the brain. Now, it's not to say that American Idol is a waste of money for Ford. They just need to change the concept. But at the present format, it certainly is deleting the brand in the brain.
Now let's get Marie Elena on the line calling from Aurora in Colorado.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Well, I just wanted to comment. I come from an island in the Caribbean, and I've been here for 30 years. But I realized that they've used the primary product that came to the island first actually became part of the language. For example, people will refer to refrigerators as frigidaires. People will refer to napkins that you clean your nose as Kleenex. And you even order a soda, not by saying soda or pop, by ordering, may I have a Coke? And then they refer, well, do you want a lime Coke or a whatever Coke? And they refer to it as a Coke. And I have found that I shop a lot of times, even if it's been 30 years, I still shop with those brands.
And I assume you make your copies on a Xerox machine, too. So
exactly. Yeah, well, that was my first job, too, was at a Xerox place. And I make Xeroxes. I don't make copies. I make Xeroxes. Exactly.
And is that the ultimate goal, to have your brand name enter the language as the embodiment of that idea?
Well, yes and no. It is a goal, and I think a lot of brand marketers are flattered by it. The problem, however, is that suddenly it actually becomes generic and the company cannot control it anymore. That's the reason why supposedly Google were objecting to put the term into the UK dictionary, saying Googling, because they were afraid of that it became a generic term for searching. And if it becomes a generic term, what happens is that they can no longer either copyrighted or trademarked or whatever type of term we are using for that particular device. So in the end of the day, it is incredibly powerful, yes, but if it goes too far, it actually turns against you and can be a little bit of a disaster.
Maria Elena, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you. Great show.
Thank you. Martin Lindstrom is our guest. His book, Buyology, Truth and Lies About Why We Buy. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email from Amanda in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I don't really have brand loyalty to any brand, but I'm willing to bet if you hooked me up to an fMRI and showed a reel of cute, brightly colored commercials from Japan, my brain would light up like the Vegas Strip. I don't know what it is about Japanese products, but I can't seem to get enough of them. I even import them on websites like eBay and JList.com. And so are Japanese advertisements better in that regard than American ones?
Oh, no, they're not. They're just very, very different. The Japanese market is known for one thing, that is that they are releasing almost three times as many new brands as in the rest of the world. We are exposed for 8 years of television commercials throughout life in Japan, only 6 years in the United States. So they actually have a competition which is incredibly hard. But what they're doing which is different is that they are building a lot of human dimensions into their commercials. So Hello Kitty and a lot of the other cartoons coming out of Japan are really human, and people love them because they can see themselves in them. You know, I spoke to a Hello Kitty fan the other day. She had 19,000 pieces of merchandising items at home. And not only that, her husband has a website called HelloKittyHell.com, which probably is not a surprise considering that his wife is so obsessed with the brand. So they do know what brand obsession is. They're really good at doing it, and lots of the fads we're seeing around the world indeed comes out of Japan. But there's other reasons why, and it's not necessarily the ads.
Let's get Mike on the line, and Mike calling us from Columbus in Ohio.
Yes, I have a comment and a question. First, a comment. I've worked in marketing and advertising for a number of years, and I wondered if this is severely regulated or controlled or whatever. How do people find out about, how are people going to find out about brands? Secondly, the question, I don't know that it's been covered so far, but how does a person form his or her initial attachments to a brand?
On that first point, I'll say that the First Amendment is going to make it awfully difficult to impose any kind of regulations on this sort of thing. But anyway, on the second point, if you would, Martin Lindstrom?
Well, the way you create a relationship with a consumer is to make sure you mirror the consumer's emotions into the brand. So if I really love a brand, typically I love it because I feel the brand understands me, but also because it reflects something which I'd like to stand for or something I can relate to. I think a good example here is the Mini Cooper, you know, the car. Now, what's interesting is that car was actually manufactured using fMRI in Germany, where they wanted to replicate a cute little baby face. And guess what? As people watched that particular car, had their brain scanned, they actually had exactly the same brain reaction as if you were watching a baby face. It was such a cute little baby face that people just wanted to touch it. That was one of the reasons why that brand became so popular, because it was a humanization of a car. And because a lot of people, in particular the female, doesn't feel that cars are very human and very sort of lovable, that really struck a chord with them. So the trick here is, if you can talk about tricks at all, is to make sure you can relate to the brand. The brand actually have an opinion you can relate to, and most importantly, that brand tells the world who you are and who you're not, because quite often we want to be seen as being more important than we are, and brands are helping us to make that happen.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you very much.
And here's an email. Todd in Southfield, Michigan, French's mustard, Heinz ketchup, and Mountain Dew. We will never stray from these brands. And, well, I guess that's typical of a lot of people. Once they're set, that's why marketers aim for that 19 to 34 niche. Once you're set with a brand, you may remain loyal to it for the rest of your life.
Well, that's right, but it's not just because we love the brand. If you take Heinz tomato ketchup, it has another feature, and that is a tactile sensation. You know, that glass bottle creates a feeling of quality, and also we feel the taste is better just because we're touching it. So what's interesting here is the tactile sensation also tells a lot about the brand. I, for example, took Toblerone chocolate, I'm in Switzerland right now, and I melted it into a chocolate bar. Gave it to consumers and said to them, what do you think about the taste? And people hated the taste. It was only when they had this triangle chocolate in the mouth they felt the taste was wonderful, even though it's exactly the same chocolate. So branding is much more than what we see. It's all our senses at play.
Martin Lindstrom, thank you for the instruction. Fascinating stuff. We appreciate your time today.
You're welcome.
Martin Lindstrom joined us. He's the author of Biology, Truth and Lies About Why We Buy. He was with us from Schweizer Radio in Bern in Switzerland. Up next, Senate seats, lies, and audio tape. What Chicagoans make of the new corruption charges, bankruptcy, and Obamamania. It's the talk of the nation from NPR News.